Hey, everybody. I'm Lisa Burwell, your host of V Speaks, Conversations with Heart and Soul. V Speaks is a layer of V Magazine that is now in its 16th year. So happy to be publishing that magazine for this long. Thank you, God. And telling stories with a much more authentic and elongated ability to tell stories in front of you on the camera. And today in studio, I have Dave King, a visionary entrepreneur, blending a unique journey, melding his love of art and technology with a computer science background. Dave, I just want to know how you have a left and a right brain. Like, how do you do this?
Yeah, it requires a lot of motivation.
It does.
Right, to be a creative entrepreneur.
It does.
It requires a lot of motivation. I think that we are really blessed to live in an area that has so many creative entrepreneurs. So I get a lot of motivation from them, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like that's that I can't imagine being able to do what I do, what we do, right, as creative entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. without having a huge community behind us that's you know, running down the same path that mm-hmm. we're running down.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've brought a lot to the community. We met about 4 years ago.
That's right.
And we had lunch in Pescado and Rosemary Beach. And it's so funny to think about the fact that at that lunch, you were telling me you were going to start a podcast. And I said, oh, that's funny. I think I had my second or third podcast underway right. at the time. And so we were definitely on the same trajectory in that manner of all that you're doing with So Wall House that you founded. And now you have created So Wall Foundation.
That's right. Yeah.
As well. Before we get into so many things about what you've done creatively in the community, how do you go from being a strategic member of a multi-million dollar hedge fund started in 2002 and making your mark and money in New York City to then retiring, I think at 39 or 40?
42.
Yeah. And you had a goal to retire early as well.
Sure. So I was obsessed with retire by 40.
Okay.
Right. I didn't realize that there's actually a curse associated with that. Right. Because people think that like, oh, once you retire, then you don't really have to do anything
right.
else.
Right.
It took me working like 80 to 100 hours a week for the vast majority of my career to get to the point that I didn't have to work anymore. And I made the horrible mistake of just turning the light switch off, mm-hmm. right? I've groomed my body and my mind to work yeah. 80 to 100 hours a week. And it was really, it was a huge struggle for me to stop all of that. Mm-hmm. So I decided to still work that hard, but only pursue creative entrepreneurial paths instead of your traditional finance path.
So when you moved here, what came first? You being restless that you weren't working in New York City, so you came here? Or did that all happen when you moved here?
Well, I took I call it a multi-year layover in Atlanta.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So I was recruited by PricewaterhouseCoopers uh-huh. and worked as a management consultant for a few years. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a boutique firm and I set up one of their cybersecurity risk management practices. So a lot of management consulting work, mm-hmm. but I actually painted my way through a computer science degree. So for the vast majority of my college degree, if I didn't sell enough artwork that semester, I didn't go to school that semester.
Wow, who was buying your art then?
So just locals okay. in Birmingham, Alabama, and mm-hmm. I was represented by a couple of art galleries that I don't even think are there anymore.
Wow. What was the medium?
A lot of found object, a lot mm. of acrylics, maybe some mm. oils, just mm. anything that I could get my hands on
wow.
to just make
Create.
Work. Yeah. Mm. I was blessed with being in a community of artists that were in Atlanta as well. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of my friends were ballet dancers
oh.
and then a couple of painters.
Really?
And I just kind of picked up from wow. them and just they were all in college. And wow. in fact, so I had dropped out of college. I just went there prematurely
mm-hmm.
and I just wasn't ready for it at all. And, my friends got together one Christmas and bought me a semester of college.
Oh, wow.
As a Christmas present.
That's
and
awesome.
It absolutely changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already thinking like, okay, now I'm motivated to really do this and I want to go to school, but I can't afford it. And my parents were like, we tried to foot the bill the first time and it didn't work out well. So you're going to pay for the rest yourself. So painting was a great way and art was a great way for me to pursue this computer science trajectory.
Wow. And, after graduating, did you still create art?
I didn't.
For how long of a period of time from then until you picked art back up again was that?
The first time that I produced a piece of work was here for our first exhibition. Yeah, so about 20 years.
Revival. 20 years.
Yeah.
Your creative side.
You know, it's one of those things like I really struggled with is there a such thing as an ex artist? Can you be an ex artist? Mm-hmm. Right? And I don't think that that's possible. I think that once you go through that gate of becoming an artist, you're an artist for life. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how often you produce work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even being an entrepreneur is an art form. You know, like
clearly.
Running a business and doing what you're doing what I'm doing. I'm not painting something on a canvas, but I do have a blank canvas that I created things.
There you go.
You know, it's similar.
The reason why I was successful in the finance industry, I was a technology management, right? So I was a technology director for a big hedge fund. The thing that got me the most recognition was my creative problem solving skills. So I could just see around math, right? And I could solve problems with a huge level of potency indirectly, right? I can twist this lever or this knob over here that people never really saw, and it can impact something way further downstream, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
They must have been sad to see you go.
I still keep in touch with pretty much everyone I've I worked in two firms in New York, and I'm still great friends with just about everybody that I worked with over there.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, they're great.
So how was it just completely awesome when you moved here to the beach, you know, having a beach life here, which is beautiful, but so different from New York? Did you embrace it or was it like kind of like, I want both of them, so I'll go back and forth?
Yeah.
How did that look?
So our area shares a lot actually with New York City. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of DNA here that most people don't realize that is not just New York City, but like major metropolitan areas. Mm-hmm. The key thing that we have in common with just about every major metropolitan area is we're a community of transplants. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very rare to be in a small coastal town and to be a genuine community of transplants. Mm-hmm. I'd say probably 90-95% of the people that I've met here are not originally from here. Mm-hmm. So I think that being a transplant has a little bit, you bond with people a little bit faster than you would otherwise. Mm-hmm. One of those things, I call it, transplanting there's a little bit of social trauma to transplanting, right? Mm-hmm. Like you're moving away from your friends. You're typically moving away from your family. Fortunately, you don't lose friends when you move to the beach.
Mm-hmm. Right? You gain them.
Your old friends come down to see you, right? And then you make new friends when you're here, right?
Very
so that kind of softens the blow. Yeah. But I think that of the people that I've spoken in depth with, most of them, we have a very common story where your first year you're just bright-eyed and, and bushy-tailed, and I can't believe this, you know, that we live in such a majestic area. Mm-hmm. By your sophomore year, right, you're okay, but what else is there, right? You get a little bit more curious. Mm-hmm. I think that people tend to, it's easier to find the things that you don't like faster than you find the things that you like. Mm-hmm. So by your sophomore year, you're finding things that you just don't like. Mm-hmm. And then your junior year, you're really starting to hone in on the things that you do like. Mm-hmm. And so I think it takes 3 to 4 years for a transplant to sort of take. And I think a lot of people mm-hmm. that you know, share the same stories, you know, that I have about being a transplant here, we all kind of experience things generally the same way.
Right. Well, right? When I moved here 32 years ago from Boston, what I loved about it and saw immediately or felt immediately was this was pioneer country.
It still is.
And yeah, that's absolutely. The part of what you were just saying that I can't believe.
Right.
And I was thinking this morning and getting ready to have our conversation. And what I've seen since you've come and then followed by the storytellers and a few other things where your pioneership was somewhat of a revival to what I remember 32 years ago. And it's impressive.
Oh, thanks.
It's very impressive what you've done. You know, at first, like, you know, and I think we were talking about this before our interview too, like there are some people that come into this town and like they kind of paint a big story and like, you know, maybe once or twice people threw out like, are they a charlatan or not? You know, like coming into our town.
Right.
So there's a little testing that goes on and you passed it really quickly. But then after you passed it, your trajectory seemed to have like rocketed, like with a great deal of momentum of things that you were making happen. And so could you tell the listeners about your vision for So Well House that now I can attest to has come true, and talk about like what the original intent, like the private club idea and
all
that.
Yeah, sure. Well, that first, thanks. That really means a lot.
You're welcome.
So Well House, really, the genesis of So Well House is a bocce ball league that Blake Jones and I started like a year prior, where we were like, we're both very community focused and oriented, and we're both entrepreneurs. And I just had this delusions of grandeur dream of like being a bocce ball league owner, because I knew someone in Atlanta that owned a bocce ball league, and I played on his league.
Okay.
And it just seemed like this guy was having the best time of his life. Mm-hmm. So I was like, maybe I'll just own a bocce ball league. It's a great sense of community that comes from this sport. So Blake and I got together and started this league, and it turned into something that was just exceeded our expectations. And we still have it to this day. We've got about 600 registered members have played in our bocce ball league. Yeah.
In our town.
Oh, yeah.
It's a huge number.
That's a huge community of people. Yeah. Now we're in, you know, two seasons a year, 6 weeks long a season, three different venues.
Oh, so you are still doing that.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Right. So we still do that. So we were like, why is this so successful? Like, where is this even coming from? Right. They didn't do it because they like Blake and I, because we were new to the area as well. People just wanted a lot of transplants here, and people wanted to find a place where other locals were that they could meet. Mm-hmm. And that's very tough to do here, or at least was at the time.
Yeah, it is connection.
Exactly. Yeah. So Well House started as a bocce ball league, and Blake and I were like, what happens if we have a physical space? Mm-hmm. We clearly have an audience. We clearly have a clientele. What happens if we create a physical space? Well, what does that space look like? Mm-hmm. It has to be authentic. What location makes sense for it? What type of business is it? And we just found the space on the south side of Rosemary Beach, and it seemed like a good real estate investment.
Yeah.
And so it was just a neat sort of gamble. Mm-hmm. And we made a commitment to not take a draw on the business and just to let it tell us what it wants to be. Mm-hmm. And it'll take however many years it takes to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's a birthplace of a lot of the creative endeavors that I go through, is just meeting other people, and the universe kind of connects me with this person to that person. And before you know it, there's a little project or a little collab, and it leads to something else. Mm-hmm. And then it snowballs into a thing. Mm-hmm.
So back then when you were inventing this with Blake, did you see comedy nights on Friday night? Did you see art openings that were too filled to capacity to a packed house. Did you see photo shoots taken there by people that are using the venue?
No.
Okay. Great.
No, not at all. It's the first business that I've ever started that we went to. We decided that the key metric of our success is going to be impact, not finance. Mm-hmm. And so it's the first business that we just like, let's not have a business plan. Let's figure out a revenue stream that might make sense. And that's how we started a club. Like maybe there's enough people that believe in what we believe that'll give us a shot. Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, our club members are really, you know, we see them as our benefactors and they're to a large degree, they're our enablers. Cause we just take all the revenue that comes from that. And we just do other fun stuff with it. Mm-hmm. And then over time, in theory, that should attract more members and more interest in our brand. Mm-hmm. And that's just what we've been able to do purely organically over time.
How many businesses do you think there are in the United States that approach it in that manner from impact, which I find incredibly impressive? And I think I share M and Kin with that with you as well.
I think you and I have this. Yeah. We share a type of creative entrepreneurial DNA all day long. I wish that there were more. I understand why there's not. It's because it's can be very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. I think that post 2020, there's probably more impact based businesses than finance based people that just want to do something because they think it has an impact. I think that it takes a long time to prove that out as a business model, unless you're a nonprofit.
Right. So this is a good segue for that then to talk about how did you add a layer to Sowell House with the Sowell Foundation?
Sure. So Sowell Foundation it's completely independent of Sowell House entirely. We like to say maybe Sowell House is like the headquarters of the foundation, but it operates as a completely separate entity all on its own. It really stemmed from us having every once in a while we host these creatives nights. So we just invite a bunch of creative entrepreneurs to Sowell House. We open the bar for them and we just give the place to them and let's see what happens. I love the idea of having a bunch of creatives in a room. The energy just feels great, right? So for whatever reason, and creatives from all walks, we don't say tonight's going to be painter night and the other night's going to be, you know, dancer night or whatever. It's just all creatives come and hang out. For whatever reason, the universe gave us almost all filmmakers that night. So just about everyone that I talked to and met was a filmmaker. A lot of commercial works filmmakers that were there. So my friend Fletcher Isaacs and I were talking to this other filmmaker, and he had asked her, you know, what do you do? And lo and behold, she says, I make film. And he said, you know, that's amazing. What type of film do you make? And I could see her posture change a little. I could see her energy kind of change a little. And she said, well, I do, you know, real estate videos and wedding videos, you know, like
bread and butter business.
Yeah. Bread and butter stuff, you know? And he said, he asked her this question that caught me totally flat footed. He said, well, that's great. I do commercial work as well, but what are you doing right now that you're proud of? And she looked at him and said, you know, I should have an answer for that. And I don't, you know, that was very intriguing for me to want to dig in and find a little bit more about like what, but why not? Like logistically, if you're a filmmaker, why aren't you doing things why aren't you taking on entrepreneurial projects that aren't commercial, right? Or more creative projects, right? And she said, well, it's just simple math. I get booked for so many gigs that it takes up all my time. So you know, the last thing that I want to do is take money away from myself in order to produce, you know, to produce a creative work that has no financial viability. Like, I'm not going to make any money off this work, and I'm going to lose work as a result, or I'm not going to be able to take on commissions as a result. Mm-hmm. I'm going to lose time. Mm-hmm. So we just had this dopey idea, and it's kind of like the genesis of the foundation. Wouldn't it be cool, Lisa, if we could commission filmmakers to produce purely creative works at their rate card?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so that's a good idea.
So and it's not just filmmakers. I think we have a community of fashion designers down here that we'd love to start, you know, contributing to. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of other creative entrepreneurial pursuits that are here in the performing arts as well. So I think something really magical happens if you give a filmmaker just full creative control of something and they're getting compensated to do it.
Because you invested in them.
Exactly. Yeah. So we raise funds through us being a nonprofit. We have our comedy festival that that is now every Valentine's Day weekend, and the sponsorship money that we're able to raise through that festival goes to the foundation to produce grants right now for independent filmmaking in the area.
So is the person you were talking about Jess Anderson?
No, but she's actually our executive director of the foundation. Yeah.
Good segue for knowing that. I didn't know that that was her position, but then also what you all did together with the Jackie Cochran story. Could you explain that?
Oh, gosh.
How did that come about?
So excited about this.
How did it come to your table?
So, remember I mentioned the universe just kind of connects things, and I just allow it to happen, right? And then we just try to see what comes of it. So I was approached by a friend of mine, Reynolds Henderson, who said, I saw this play. It's a one woman play. And I think it's about it's about someone that was raised in the area. That's this aviator. And I think that you should host the play at Sewell House. We'd never hosted a play before, right? We'd done some stand-up comedy. We'd done some singer songwriter nights, but we'd never hosted a one woman play. And so because it's Reynolds, and he has my absolute, if he says something's great, that means it's great. So he introduced me to this playwright that retired and moved to Dufuniac, named Nancy Hasty. And I said, sure, let's try this play out. So we did it. And Lisa, it was the most riveting, impactful performance that we've ever hosted at Sewell House. Wow. And I was like, it feels like I know a bunch of filmmakers. I've got a little bit of that craft in my own DNA. It feels like we need to probably turn this into a documentary. And she was like, that's my goal is that this will be the culmination of my life's work is to see that this thing gets made to film. So we've spent probably 2 years on this project at this point. And I'm confident that we'll probably release it like February, maybe March at the latest, 2025.
Where will you show that film, the debut showing? Will it be at Sewell?
We'll have some private screenings at Sewell House. And then we're looking at a few larger venues for it. And we're going to make a big to-do of it. It's really exciting stuff.
Yeah. Love it. So let's talk about your podcast, because we're fellow podcasters. And what do you think of the medium?
I'm in love with it. I'm absolutely in love with the medium. Yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah, I'm absolutely in love with it. I think that it's hard to be inauthentic in a podcast, and that's what I love so much about it, that you can literally just invite someone over. Yeah. Maybe you know them really well, or maybe you know them not that well, but by the end of an interview, you're going to know them so much more. It's just such a great medium. I'll admit, like, starting the Sewell House podcast, it's very much a selfish endeavor on my part. I really started it simply wanting to have an excuse to talk to people that I admire. And just bringing people in and getting to know them a little bit better. Yeah. And I think that if you ask someone, kind of cold. If you ask someone, can I take you out to coffee? It's like, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
Would you like to come onto my podcast? Mm-hmm. I'd love to interview you. Mm-hmm. That has a different ring to mm-hmm. it, right?
It does, yeah.
So I used it as a way to flesh out my curiosities about people. Mm-hmm. And turns out, I think that our podcast has been successful because I'm asking the questions that any mm-hmm. other person would probably want to ask someone. I'll give you an example. One of my favorite episodes. I was really just blown away by it. So I had Robert Davis, mm-hmm. Founder mm-hmm. of Seaside, mm-hmm. Before we started the podcast, he said, "Look, I'm going to be short on time, probably only about a half hour or so." He's a very, very busy guy, and I was just felt absolutely lucky to have him, for that half hour. But as we got to talking, I kind of tapped my watch when we were getting close to the half hour mark, and he kind of signaled, let's keep going, right? And that podcast episode, I think, is probably an hour and a half long. That's edited, great. And so he was probably with us for about 2 hours. And it's just, we just got in this great conversation. Drew Thondi was there as well. Mm-hmm. We just had this fantastic conversation where I learned so much about him mm-hmm. and his wife, Daryl, and Seaside. And I got the chance, as I was talking with him, I was realizing other people, I have to ask questions that other people would probably want to ask as well. Mm-hmm. So I asked him this question. I said, if someone snapped a Polaroid of Seaside right now and went in a time machine and went back to the 80s, and showed you that Polaroid, mm-hmm. would you feel joyful about Seaside as it's grown? And I'll let all the listeners here to see this podcast, I'll let them listen to that episode mm-hmm. for his response. Mm-hmm. But he has this absolutely beautiful response. Mm-hmm. So I followed it up with several minutes later, if someone got in a time machine right now and went 40 years forward and snapped a Polaroid and brought it back to you, what would you hope to see in Seaside? And his response to that is just absolutely remarkable. So this podcast medium gives us this mm-hmm. chance to mm-hmm. ask people that mm-hmm. we admire mm-hmm. questions mm-hmm. like this. Mm-hmm. And it's just an incredible medium.
Yeah. He that was a great person for you to interview. And Daru too was on
and
the podcast.
And Daru's all, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, pretty fascinating. He is the definition of a true quintessential entrepreneur and a visionary.
Absolutely. Sure.
I mean, that man, and very, very smart, and he can see things that others cannot see, and what he birthed in that new urbanism movement. That, and you and I are both on the board of governors with the Seaside Institute, so we have a passion for supporting right. what he did
right.
40 years ago and what it became globally, but also what it became for everybody here on 30A and beyond, which is how most of us made our livelihood over the last 40 years because of them breaking ground in Seaside.
Right. I can't imagine what the area would be like without that impact.
Right. And that was so impactful.
Yeah.
And all that has happened with that town. I mean, he's pretty intelligent guy and surrounds himself with a lot of intelligent people.
That's exactly
he's
right.
very heady yeah. and it's so fun, but he just celebrated his 81st birthday, and the guy has the energy probably that could rival ours. I mean, he really does right. have a lot of energy.
Right.
And is just doing it, and he didn't slow down, and he's a race car driver. Did you know that?
That does not surprise me for some strange reason.
He owns like 3 race cars, and he just did the Mille Miu in Rome, I guess, maybe 3 months ago with Micah.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
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 That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that I do believe that that type of creative entrepreneurial DNA, it exists here.
It does.
Right. It's like a pixie dust that exists here.
It is
I think that, I would be willing to bet that if someone were to, go back in time 40, 45 years, mm-hmm. It would be interesting to see someone try to talk Robert on a pure balance sheet financial basis out of doing Seaside, because at the time that made no financial sense at all whatsoever.
Right.
Like, the thing that makes sense is that you put in high rises.
Right.
You put in high rises and
and
you do that thing with it.
Well, it became much more successful than they thought it was going to become.
Wildly successful.
And they didn't bank on that, really. Literally, they did not bank on
that. But that would have been the easy path.
Yeah.
It's like, let's make our entrepreneurial decisions based off of financial projections as opposed to based off of potential impact, right? Potential healthy impact.
Right.
I think my business does the exact same thing. I think your business, it's impact driven.
Right. Well, it's kind of like, it's a little simplistic for me to say what I'm about to say, but it's almost like if you do the right thing, and you have a heart for something, and you, if you do it with excellence, you know, ergo, you'll be successful, because that's kind of the ethos of the All-American Dream. You know, and really, that's what I've done, you know. And sometimes I'm like, hey, does this All-American Dream really work? Like, this is way harder.
Well, I think it forces us to define success outside of traditional terms, right? Like, I would much rather own a business that is driven by impact results than
bottom line.
Than bottom line. Like, it, every day of the week.
Right. Well, on that note, I wasn't going to really bring this up, but let me tell you a funny story about Robert from way back when, because that's how I moved here and was the marketing director at Seaside. And I had just like a small job there. You know, he was all with his architects and his people from all Ivy League schools doing their thing, you know, and they're in the conference rooms and everything, like the Rome Prize and all that he was doing back then. But I enjoyed talking to him, and I know he enjoyed talking to me too about ideas. So he called me into his office one day, which I think was kind of radical, because I probably wasn't on the tier of the pecking order to be called into his office, you know. So he said, how am I going to make more money? Because, you know, X amount of, like, I only have like maybe 10 plots of land, and the Merchants Association and the dues and how all of the merchants were going to survive was going to be technically his sustainability. So he said, how can I put Seaside on the map? And how will, like, everybody know about it? So I'm sitting in his office, and he has all these beautiful architectural, like, flawless photos taken by Stephen Brooks out of Miami, a friend of his, and they're still friends. And the wall was littered with that and all these photos that they had spent so much money on. And I said, well, just put all of those in a big white binder, and you send it to scouting agents in Hollywood, and then you'll get a movie made here. So a year and a half later, Peter Weir, the director, came, scouted it out for The Truman Show, and then the movie was made. But the real part of the story that I didn't know until only 2 or 3 years ago, when I interviewed Robert on my podcast, is that he said at that time, and I think he probably even forgot that we had had that conversation, which is fine. But at that time, he said, we were on the verge of bankruptcy, and we did not know how we were going to keep Seaside open in 1997. And he said the movie saved the town because of all the money that the movie had to pay him to use it as a venue and all that. And I'm just sitting there listening to him, and I'm thinking to myself,
it's incredible.
I didn't say anything else except I didn't know that part of the story.
Yeah.
But that goes back to what we were just saying, where he couldn't do anything else. That was what he wanted to do. That was his passion. That was his legacy that he was going to do, whether he made money or not.
Right.
And you and I were talking earlier about that too. Like, sometimes you just do things and it doesn't make money. And sometimes you have to figure out how to make
sometimes
money.
That's okay. I think that if you're producing impact, right? If that's your GDP is impact, then as a creative entrepreneur, and I wouldn't say that about any other type of business, right? But if your GDP is impact, then when you just need a win, right? When you're at the nearing the bottom of the barrel, financially, emotionally, mentally, right? When you need a win, if the impact resonates, I do believe that the universe will grant you enough of whatever it is to keep you moving forward. And if you're not presenting enough impact, then it won't. And I think that so we at Sewell House and at Sewell Foundation, it is an those are impact driven first organizations. Absolutely. For that reason.
Right. So I know that you started going back and forth from here to New York, like maybe a year, year and a half ago, when you started, you know, back into your stomping, old stomping grounds, right? What is going on in New York? And what are you doing there?
So I've got a top secret project that I'm not ready to announce or release yet, but I have two projects that I am ready to talk about. So we bought a I call it an artist loft, and we designed it after J.D. Salinger's book Catcher in the Rye. So all of the aesthetics of the studio apartment that has a beautiful view of a brick wall, the aesthetics of the apartment are like what I would imagine Holden Caulfield, you know, if he grew, you know, the main character in Catcher in the Rye, if he had grown up.
He'd live there?
To live in a studio apartment in Midtown, then this would be what his apartment would look like. It's actually exactly one block from J.D. Salinger's childhood home. I just kind of fell in love with the place, and I had this great opportunity to make this investment, to buy this little apartment and turn it into this fun thing. So we call it Salinger House.
And it's a studio.
And it's a 400 square foot studio apartment. Okay. All right. The vision that we have for it is I would love to see, you know, we have this amazing nonprofit called Escape to Create here, where we, you know, the area brings in that nonprofit brings in artists from out of town and gives them residency here. And that's an amazing, it's just an amazing concept. I would love to do something polar opposite, where it's let's take local artists and ship them to New York. For a week or two and just let them create or not create, or just really get out of our beach town to a thriving, you know, our thriving beach town to a thriving metropolis, and let's just see what impact that does over their work. And, you know, in theory, if that impacts their work in some healthy way, then we're all impacted by having artists live and produce here that have been impacted.
That's cool.
Right.
Is that under the auspices of the foundation or
that's right.
That is.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So that's a product that we'll have to seek more, you know, sponsorships and donations. So donors will be able to sponsor an artist to live in New York for up to 2 weeks.
Awesome.
And they'll stay in the Salinger House, which again, it's a 400 square foot studio apartment with a beautiful view of a brick wall, which is exactly what an artist loft should be. So I'm just absolutely in love with that.
The other
project that I'm working on are walking tours. So when I lived in New York prior, I was a volunteer tour guide for a company called Big Apple Greeters that only advertised their tours for European travelers. So they only advertised in Europe, and it was funded by the New York City version of the TDC. Right. So I just was like, well, while I'm in the city, I've got this other top secret project that I'm not willing to talk about yet, but also have this, I used to do these walking tours and I never really formalized them. I never like put them down on paper. And so I started, because I'm serial entrepreneur. Actually, I started a company called Urban Hiker Guide, and that company produces self-guided walking tours through an iPhone app.
In New York, or just can be anywhere.
Our first walking tour is in New York.
Okay.
But I plan on producing walking tours for Rosemary and Seaside and Alice. I would love to do a walking tour of Dufuniac Springs, mm-hmm. downtown Panama City. I think Grayton Beach would be an amazing tour. Mm-hmm. Walking tours are magical, and they're a very close cousin to podcasts, mm-hmm. right? The main difference between a walking tour, a self-guided walking tour, and a podcast, you're still listening to the human voice. But the main difference is that you're more active listening, right? Mm. Because my voice is pointing at things
you're
and
teaching.
Saying, look at that. Mm-hmm. There's a huge mm-hmm. educational aspect mm-hmm. to it that is just phenomenal and so enriching. So I'm very passionate about it, and I plan on producing, I've got one that's already been produced. I plan on producing probably 10 walking tours in 2025.
Wow. Are you the voice?
And I'm the voice.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. So now tell the audience about the scientific study about voices and the power of a voice and the credibility.
Sure. Well, I went to a podcast conference a couple of years ago, and they had a podcaster who their niche was psychology, and they were giving this amazing lecture on the power of the human voice and how influential somebody's voice is. And it doesn't even matter what someone says. It's we form a bond with people that we hear often. So why is that? And it has everything to do with just the fluctuations in the structure of the human voice. Mm-hmm. So the more that somebody hears your voice, the more trust they build with you. And I'm just absolutely in love with that concept. Mm-hmm. So for our walking tours, I actually, and this kind of delves into another topic that I think is just really fascinating. I delved into modeling my voice so that I wouldn't have to jump into a sound studio every time that I have to record a walking tour episode. Mm-hmm. I can actually produce my voice while in a noisy coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's absolutely fascinating to be able to model the human voice and still have it be authentic. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would love to do when it's time to produce the Seaside Walking Tour, I would love to model it with Robert Davis's voice. Mm-hmm. And then it could live on forever.
Legacy. Such a legacy.
I think that that's really amazing. Yeah. So I've spent the better part of the summer trying to figure out exactly how to make that work and how to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think I've cracked the code.
Oh, really? Like
I think I can actually do that. Yeah. I can model your voice as well. Yeah. We can make your voice live forever, Lisa.
Tell me how you do that. What is that like?
It's AI is maturing at such a rapid rate that I think that we're almost to the point of only being limited by our creative thought. And never in the human experience has that ever happened before. So I found out about voice modeling from my own frustration with, I had to fly back to Florida. I read my script for my walking tour in my podcast studio, so it sounded, you know, nice and clean and crisp and professional. I flew back up to the city the next day, only to listen to it, follow my script, and there was one part where I said turn left when I should have said turn right. And it meant that I had to re-record that part. But there was no way that I was not going to jump on a plane and fly back down again just to record one word. So I tried to overdub it myself, and it just did not sound the same. And so I just said, well, that's it. I'm going to take a week off from all of my other experiments
dalliances.
All my other, you know, whatever, all the other work that I'm doing in New York. I'm just going to take a week off. There's a lot of tech industry in New York. I'm going to find some tech people that are probably facing the same issue, and I'm going to figure out a solution. And that led me to just kind of teaching myself about AI voice modeling. And the power behind it's really amazing, because once you have your voice modeled and it sounds authentic, I call it has to pass the mom test. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to play it for your your parents, and if they can detect that it's AI, then it's no good, right?
By the way, this is frightening to me. I know that it might seem like a real time saver for you, but this is frightening.
It's definitely cutting edge.
Yeah.
And it's really weird to hear yourself say things that you did not say.
That's unbelievable.
It's really unbelievable.
But also on the tier of unbelievable is that you figured that out in a week.
I just have a knack for that sort of stuff. Like if I can deep dive into something, I call it Red Bull and pizza-ing the situation.
Understood. Right?
Then I'll just deep dive into it and I'll figure it out. At least I can probably get to about 80% of expert level on most things if I can just give myself a dedicated slot of time just to focus on that. Then that other 20%, I'll leave that up. I'll just outsource that to the experts.
Okay, so let me talk about sort of the thing about the voice. Like, we're all made individuals. We have different sounding voices. We look different. You know, we're not all homogenous, you know, robotic human beings. And I know a lot of celebrities and people that like make their livelihood with their voice or whatever, they do not like this at all. And
sure.
This is why all of Hollywood was up in arms about not having AI take over their jobs. So talk to me about like that, like ethically,
yeah.
Why is it
okay? Yeah, it's a timely topic.
Why is it okay to take someone's voice and use it?
Yeah. So the platform that I use is called 11 Labs, and it has a very interesting way of ensuring that someone's voice doesn't get captured inappropriately. So it requires you to authenticate your voice by reading a certain just random sentences that pop up. And so that's what gets you approval. So, for example, if I wanted to clone your voice in AI, there's no way that I would be able to do that without your approval. So you would have to sit down at my laptop and read this short script in order to make that happen. So I like that those types of controls are in place. Now, I can probably model something that's pretty close to your, probably model something that's
without
pretty close.
Without my permission, because
it wouldn't,
yeah, it wouldn't pass the mom test,
it but wouldn't it would, pass it would the be mom okay. test,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it would probably get there.
Yeah.
I think that voice actors especially, I think they're right in that they're jobs are in jeopardy over the technology that's coming along.
It's
right.
True.
I think that's totally fair.
But what about George Orwell and the propaganda and like someone being able to like imitate anyone's voice and what the world would look like? Like, how will you tell truth from fiction in the future?
That's scary stuff. Yeah. I wish I had an answer to that portion of it. But if we take a step back, from a creative standpoint, if we're just talking about pure creativity, I think that AI is nothing more than a really powerful tool in an artist's arsenal. So an example of that, last fall, I produced a series of works that I titled St. Walton. There's no place called St. Walton, right? And no one had ever been sainted with the name Walton, right? So I produced a series of pieces called St. Walton that was a pure fiction suite of what would have happened, like a what-if scenario. What would have happened if Walt Disney had purchased all the land in Northwest Florida that he had tried to purchase? And he actually,
I saw
Disney
your
World
podcast
was supposed to
with,
be here.
With Rhea.
That's
we
right.
We talked about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's just so fascinating. So what would
so
this
really
area look like? Absolutely.
Okay. And so, why did Disney pass on this area?
Ed Ball invited Walt Disney down to his office to meet with him to discuss the terms of the purchase. Walt Disney showed up, was led into Ed Ball's office. Ed Ball wasn't there and was told to wait for him. Walt Disney waited there all day. And when it came closing time, I'm guessing around 5 o'clock or so, Walt Disney finally went up to the receptionist and said, was he ever going to show up? And she said, no, that was his message. Effectively, that was his message to you to let you know that he's not interested. Oh. So he didn't want you to waste his time. So he would rather waste yours. So this is not going to happen. Ed Ball's phrase that he used to do toasts at dinners was confusion to the enemy, and he would toast over it. And so this is one of those tactics. Mm-hmm. But Ed Ball is the sole reason why this whole area didn't become the home of Disney World. But if it had, and people can debate all day long as to whether or not that would have been a good thing or a bad thing. I personally am very grateful that love Disney World. Mm-hmm. I'm just grateful that it's not here, right? Mm-hmm. But the area would have been really amazing. It would have looked like a pretty amazing city. We're talking about the mid-1960s. Mm. So we probably would have been the main airport hub and not Atlanta. This would probably have been one of the top five largest cities in the entire country that just so happens to sit on white quartz sand. And that's just amazing think about. So I produced a series of artworks that were AI assisted that depict what our area would look like had it came to fruition.
How can I see that? And how can the audience see that?
We're doing for the Seaside Prize. Mm-hmm. Ann Hunter has graciously allowed us to post all of those pieces in the Ann Hunter Gallery in Seaside right next to Amavita. Yeah. So in February,
first weekend of February.
There you go. So we'll have an exhibition there about St. Walton, and we'll kind of try to tie it in. There's definitely like a new urbanist conversation to be had about those pieces as well.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
So interesting. We have so much going on. Is there anything else? And I know we could talk for many more hours, but anything else that you want to talk about what you're doing or our area? Oh, and I will interject that I'm glad Disney did not decide to be here. This is my opinion.
I think the general sentiment is that it is very interesting
to see what if,
which is fair.
What if the history was different?
Right.
That's interesting.
Right. I just love those what if scenarios. Yeah. What I do want to touch on before we leave is I think comedy is also an artistic medium that's absolutely magical and it's absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's something about being in a room full of people with laughter bonds them together in a very real, authentic, magical way. Mm-hmm. So we produce a comedy festival called Sand Up Comedy Festival. Now we're committed to doing it every Valentine's Day weekend. Mm-hmm. So everyone has plans now for Valentine's Day, February 14th. Come to a show at the festival. We'll be bringing in dozens of comedians, career touring comedians from all over the country and it's a multi-venue sort of festival. Mm-hmm. So we'll have probably six, if not seven venues between Panama City and South Walton. Again, dozens of comedians. It's just going to be an amazing time.
Wow.
We had our first one in 2024 and everybody loved it. So we were like, I think we're onto something.
Panama City is happening and it has a really cool artist community there.
It does.
And film and everything that they're doing right now, I think it reminds me of Seaside 30 years ago. I mean, 30 years ago with a lot of talented creatives and pioneers. And I love seeing like it mushroom there. And I think it's unbelievable.
If people haven't been to downtown Panama City in a while,
that's to go.
They've got to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really amazing.
Let's just tell the listeners about how they can become a member of Sowall House and all of that. I mean, we'll put it up on the screen too, but is it invite only or can people ask to become a member?
They can fill out an interest form.
Okay.
So if they just go to sowallhouse.com, it lists all of our events. Mm-hmm. By the way, now we host live jazz music every Friday and Saturday night.
Okay.
And so they can see the list of the roster performers that are playing
every Friday and Saturday.
Every Friday and Saturday
night.
When did
you start doing that?
We started doing that in October just as what would happen if we opened the windows and let jazz kind of permeate the town square. Mm-hmm. And something magical happened. So now we just committed to do that every weekend.
That's great.
But the interest form, the calendar of events is first and foremost on our website. And then if they scroll down, they can see the interest form to to join Atlas Club.
Love it.
Yeah.
When will you be able to announce your big secret that you can't announce yet?
Actually, I have two big secrets.
Okay.
But it'll be 2025.
Okay.
They're big.
Well, can't wait to hear that, because everything that you've done in a very short period of time here is commendable, impressive.
Thank you.
And
it means a lot to be here, by the way. Like you're someone that I absolutely look up to and admire, and I just love everything that you do, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Right back at you. Thanks for being here. Hey, everyone, I hope you love this. Dave is a thinker, he is a doer, and he is a creative, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone, have a good day. Bye-bye.